That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove.
This is Dan Klingel, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will be reading part two of three parts of Above the Law, originally published in 1918 by Max Brand. Max Brand was a nom de plume of Frederick Faust. In our first episode, we met La Belle Geraldine, or Jerry, born Annie Kerrigan, and Frederick Montgomery, Freddy to his friends, two down-on-their-luck thespians marooned in a California gold mining town. In a desperate attempt to improve their fortunes, they decide to execute a stagecoach robbery, with Jerry charming the stagecoach driver, while Freddy plays the part of a notorious local highwayman, Black Jim, to make off with the loot. Everything is going according to plan until the stagecoach is stopped and robbed by the real Black Jim, a fact that Jerry still hasn't figured out as we join her in Black Jim's cabin hideout, where she is nursing a wound sustained when Black Jim shot a small revolver out of her hand. Black Jim has tied her ankles and gone out, and she is surprised when he suddenly returns. Or maybe he doesn't. Chapter 4, Black Jim. "Jerry," he said in a strange whispering voice. She eyed him with infinite disgust. "Playing a new role, Freddy, aren't you?" she sneered. He merely stared. "You're versatile, all right," she went on. "First the grim bandit, and then the astonished friend. Say, dearie, do you expect warm applause?" "No, cutie, but if I had some spoiled eggs, I'd certainly pass them to you."
"Jerry, you're raving."
She gritted her teeth. "I'm through with the funny stuff, you one-syllable, lock-jawed baby. Now, I mean business. Get me out of this as fast as they looked you off the boards the last time you tried out in Manhattan."
"Do you have will?"
"Bah," she said. "Don't you get next that I'm through with this one-night stand? Drop the curtain and start the orchestra on Home Sweet Home. Talk sense. Cut this rope. I'm starting, and I'm starting alone."
"For God's sake, Jerry."
"Lay off that stuff, dearie. If words made a cradle, you'd rock the world to sleep.
How did you come here?"
She stared at him a moment and then broke into rather sinister laughter. "I suppose you've been walking in your sleep, what? I suppose I'm to fall for this bum line, Freddy?" "Not me. You can't get by even in a mask, Mr. Montgomery."
"Geraldine!"
"Call me Annie for short."
"Upon my word!"
"Can the talk, cutie. You can tell the rest to the judge."
"But how can I help you?"
he asked. He turned, and she saw his hands tied securely together behind him. While she still stared at this marvelous revelation, the door opened again, and another Montgomery strode into the room. He was the same build as the other man. He wore the same sort of mask. His hair was black. But he could not be Montgomery. It was only when they stood together that she felt a significant difference in this man. Seeing Jerry with the hunting knife in her hand, he crossed the room and loomed above her.
"Give me the knife," boomed the musical bass voice.
She shrank back and clutched the heavy handle more closely.
"Keep away,"
she cried hoarsely.
"Give me the knife."
"Black Jim," breathed Jerry, for the first time wholly frightened, while her mind whirled in confusion. "Is the whole world made up of doubles, or am I losing my brain? Keep off, Mr. Mystery, or I'll make hash of you with this cleaver." She held the knife poised. The man observed her with a critical eye.
Fighter," he decided.
He leaned again. His hand darted out with the speed of a striking snake. She cut at him furiously, but the hand caught her wrist and stopped the knife while it was still an inch from his face.
He shook her hand, and the numbing grasp made her fingers relax. The knife clattered on the floor, and he carried her back to the pile of blankets. When she opened her eyes again, she saw Black Jim loosing the hands of Montgomery.
"No use in we all staying masked anymore," said the bandit. "I've been down and seen the other boys. I thought maybe they'd vote yes on turning the girl loose again. I told them she was too sick to see anything when I brought her in. I told her I'd blindfold her when I took her out to the road again. But they all sort of figure she'd be able to track back with a posse following just a sense of direction like a hoss. They vote that she stays here, and so it makes no difference what she sees."
He finished untying Montgomery's hands and drew off his mask. Her faintness left Jerry. She saw a lean-faced man with great dark eyes, singularly lacking in emotion, and a forehead unfurrowed by worries. Montgomery likewise withdrew his mask and showed a face familiar enough, but drawn and colorless.
"All I'm asking," said Black Jim, "is have you got anything against me?"
"I?" queried Montgomery, and he drew a slow hand across his forehead as if he were partially dazed.
"Yes, you," said the other,
and the dark eyes dwelt carefully on Montgomery's face.
"If you've got any lingering suspicion that there's something coming from you to me, we'll just naturally step out and make our little play where there's room."
"Not a thing against you, my friend," said Montgomery with a sudden heartiness for which Jerry despised him. "You had the drop on me, and I guess you had special reasons for wanting that stage." The outlaw shrugged his shoulders.
"I gotta go out again," he said, "and I'm gonna ask you to watch this girl while I'm gone."
"Glad to," said Montgomery. Black Jim turned, paused, and came back.
"If anything happens to her, my friend," he hesitated significantly, "the boys seemed to be sort of excited when I told them about her being in my cabin," he explained. "If they all come up here, don't let them come in. You got a gun."
He stepped to the door and was gone. The eyes of Jerry and Montgomery met.
"Quick," she ordered. "Talk out and tell me what has happened, Freddy, or I'll go crazy. I'm half out of my head now."
"It's Black Jim," he said heavily.
"I knew that half an hour ago. Your brains are petrified, Freddy. Start where I'm blank. How'd you come here?"
"He held me up."
"Black Jim?"
"Yeah. I was waiting behind the rock with my mask on. I heard a horse coming up the road from behind. When I turned, I was looking into the mouth of a pistol as big as a cannon. I put up my hands. I just stared at him. I couldn't speak. He said he was sorry he couldn't leave the job to me. He said there were two things clear to him. He went on to thinking them over while his gun covered me. Then he told me that he couldn't leave me alive near the road. He had to take me up to his camp. Then he came up behind me and tied my hands behind my back. Jerry, I felt that if he hadn't thought me one of his own sort, he'd have dropped the curtain on my act forever." He shuddered slightly at the thought.
"He made me ride before him up here," he went on, "and he put me in this cabin. As far as I can make out, we're in a little gulch of the mountains. It's a sort of bandit's refuge, the sort of thing that paper you read me told about. When we rode over the edge of the hill and dipped down into the valley, I saw some streaks of smoke down the canyon. There must be a half dozen places like this one, and some of the outlaws in every one. What'll we do, Jerry? For God's sake, what'll we do?"
"Shut up,"
she said fiercely, and her face was whiter than mere exhaustion could make it.
Let me think.
Montgomery had no eye for her. He strode up and down the room with a wild eye. He seemed to think of her as an aftermath.
"What happened to you? Was it Black Jim again?"
"I pulled my gun and shot in the air. He shot the pistol out of my fingers and put my hand on the blink. I fainted. He brought me up here. That's all."
Her thoughts were not for her troubles.
"I'm going to make a break for it," he cried at last. "Maybe I can get free."
She recognized him without emotion.
and leave me here?" she asked.
He flushed, stammered, and avoided her eyes.
"It doesn't make any difference," he muttered. "I couldn't find my way out, and maybe they'd take a pot shot at me as I tried to get away. It's better to die quick than starve in the mountains. But by God, Jerry, what'll he do when he finds out that I'm not an outlaw like himself?"
"Stop crying like a baby," she said. "I've got to think." "There's only one thing for you to do," she said at last, raising her head, "and that's for you to play your part as he sees it. You can act rough. Go down and mix with them, but be here with me when Black Jim is here. They can only kill you, Freddy, but me..."
Her eyes were roving again.
"Maybe I can do it," he said rapidly, half to himself. "Pray to God that I can do it."
Chapter 5. The Stage Man. Her upper lip curled.
"You're in a blue funk, a blue funk," she said. "Here, Freddy, here's your one chance in life to play the man. Do you see my condition? Do you see the little act that's mapped out ahead for me? It's as clear as the palm of your hand. He brought me up here because he thought I'd die if he left me in the road. Even his heart was not black enough for that. But once he had me here, it wasn't in his power to send me away. That's what he meant when he said he had talked to the boys. They wouldn't let me go, because they thought I might be able to find the way back and bring a posse after them. Don't you see? They have me a prisoner, and you're all that I have to protect me."
She stopped and moaned softly.
"Why was I ever born a woman?"
He moistened his lips.
"I'll do what I can," he mumbled. "But did you see that devil's eye? He isn't human, Jerry."
"I might have known," she murmured to herself. "I might have known he was only a stage man."
She said aloud,
"There's one chance in a thousand left to me, Freddy. But there's no chance at all unless you'll help me. Will you?"
All that I can, in reason," he stammered miserably.
"It's this," she went on, trying to sweep him along with her. "You had your eyes open when you came up here. Maybe you can find the way out again, Freddy. You said on the road today that you loved me. Freddy, I'll go to hell and slave for you as long as I live. If you'll fight for me now, tell me again that you love me and you'll be a man."
His lips were so stiff that he could hardly speak in answer.
"I didn't tell you one thing," he said. "When we came over the top of the hill at the edge of the valley, we passed an armed man. They keep a sentry there."
She pointed with frantic eagerness.
"You have your gun at your belt. That'll free us, I tell you. It's only one man you have to fight."
He could not answer. His eyes wandered rapidly around the room like a boy already late for school and striving miserably to find his necessary book.
"Then if you won't do that, cut the rope that holds my feet and I'll go myself," she cried. "I'll go. I'd rather a thousand times die of starvation than wait for the time when the eyes of that fiend light up with hellfire."
"Black Jim," he answered, and stopped.
She loosened her dress at the throat as if she was stifled.
"For God's sake, Freddy, you have a sister. I've seen her picture. For her sake."
He was utterly white and striving to speak.
"He would know it was me who did it," he said at last. "And then..."
Voices sounded far away. They listened with great eyes that stared at each other, but saw only their own imaginings. The voices drew closer.
"The door! The door!" she whispered. "Lock the door! They're coming! The men he warned us about!"
He was frozen to the spot on which he stood.
"Ho!"
cried a voice from without.
"Montgomery!"
she moaned, wringing her hands. At last he walked hastily to the door.
"You can't come in here," he answered.
"Why the hell not?" roared one of them.
"Because of Black Jim."
A silence followed.
"Is he in there?"
"No, but he wants no one else to come in while he's gone."
They parleyed.
"Shall we chance it?"
"Not me."
"Why not?"
"Let's see his woman."
"Sure. Seeing her doesn't do no harm."
"Who's in there?"
It's the pal he brought up.
Are we going to act like a bunch of shorthorns? Asked a deeper voice. I'm going in.
A dozen men broke into the room. At the first stir of the door, Jerry dropped prone to the blankets and feigned sleep. The crowd gathered first about Montgomery, searching him with curious eyes.
Here's the new lamb, said a lithe, white-faced man, and he grinned over yellow teeth. Here's another rope for the Brandon. Let's pass on him now, boys.
A chuckle, which rang heavily on the heart of Montgomery, ran around the circle. But though his soul was lead in him, his art came to his rescue. After all, this was merely a part to be played. It was a dangerous part indeed, but with a little effort he should be able to pass before an uncritical audience. He leaned back against the wall and smiled at the group. It required every ounce of his courage to manage that smile.
Look me over, boys, he responded. Take a good long look. And in case you're curious, maybe you'll find something interesting on my right hip.
He broke off the smile again. For one instant the scales hung in the balance. What he said might have been construed as a threat, but the smile took the sting out of his words. After all, a man who had been passed by Black Jim himself had some rights among them.
You're a cool one, all right, grinned a man who was bearded like a Russian, with his shirt open and a great black hairy chest partially exposed. But where'd you get that color? Been doing inside work?
Mac, said Montgomery, easily, for the last remark gave him courage. And some of the boys call me Silent Mac. I'm a bit off color, all right. That's because some legal gents got interested in me. They got so damned interested in me that they thought I shouldn't be out in the sun so much. They thought maybe it was spoiling my complexion, see? They fixed a plant and sent me up the river to a little joint the government runs for restless people. Yep, I've just had a long rest cure, and now I'm ready for business.
A low laugh of understanding ran around the group. A jailbird has standing in the shadow of the law.
You'll do, pal, said the yellow-toothed one. You can enter the baby show, all right, said another. I'm the doctor.
I've heard of you, said Montgomery, as the crowd passed him to examine Jerry.
Know anything about the calico? Asked one of Montgomery.
Not a thing, answered the latter carelessly, except that Jim picked it off the stage.
And a damn bad job, too, growled he of the beard. Where's he going to fence her up in a corral like this?
Bad job, your eye, answered one who leaned far over to glance at her partially covered face. She's a looker, boys. She's a regular Cleopatra. They grouped closely around her.
Wake her, suggested one, so we's can size her up.
One who stood closer stirred her rudely with his foot. She sat up yawning, rubbing her eyes, and smiled up to their faces.
Turn me into a wall-eyed cayuse, muttered one of them,
but the others were silent while their eyes drank.
Montana Pete, with a mop of tawny hair falling low down on his forehead, dropped to a squatting position, the better to look into her eyes.
Well, baby blue eyes, he grinned, what do you think of your new pals?
Oh, she cried with a semblance of pretty confusion.
Where am I? Oh, I remember.
Boys, said Montana Pete, rising, we ain't the kind to have a king, but I'm all for a queen.
Sure, said the doctor. There ain't nothing like the woman's touch to make a home. They roared with laughter.
Look out, she's remembering some more, and here comes the waterfall, called another.
Jerry, in order to get time to plan her campaign, broke into heart-rending sobs. The bearded man, who rejoiced in the name of Porky Martin, now came forward again.
Let me take care of her, he said. I had 2 mothers, 6 sisters, 14 sweethearts. I know all about women.
He dropped to one knee and put his arm around her.
Take it easy, kid. You're running loose now and we'll give you all the rope you want, except enough for hanging yourself. Look around you, kid. Here's enough men to make a jury, and you got a home with every one.
Am I right, boys?"
"Leave me alone," wailed Jerry,
and she shuddered under the caress.
"Huh?" growled Porky Martin. "She's proud, damn her."
"Give her time, give her time," said the doctor. "The kid's hurt. She don't savvy yet, boys. But she's in a real democracy where everything's common property."
"No more fooling," advised Montana Pete. "Jim will be coming back any time. He'll sure be glad to find us here."
"I guess not."
"Who's Black Jim?" snarled Porky Martin. "I've stood for enough of his nutty ideas."
"I say to hell with Black Jim. We've had enough of him."
"Say that to him," said Montana, easily. "I won't hold your hands, Porky."
"Take it easy, kid," this to Jerry. "We ain't all swine."
"What do you mean?" said Porky in a rising voice.
Jerry trembled, for she knew that if the men began fighting over her, her fate was sealed.
"You ain't dear, I reckon,"
said Montana Pete, with obvious scorn.
"Let me go," cried Jerry,
not that she hoped for freedom, but because she thought that there was some chance of changing the issue.
"Let me go, let me go. I won't tell about you. I swear I won't."
She extended her hands, one slender and white, and then the other in its ominously stained bandage, first to Porky Martin and then to Pete.
"Look at that," said Pete.
"We're a fine gang to stand around making life hell for the kid."
He dropped to one knee beside her.
"We'll give you a square deal. You lay to that, but we can't let you go. There ain't a hope of that, understand?"
She shrank against the wall, her sobs coming heavily at intervals.
"What I say is this," orated Porky Martin. "What do you make out of Jim bringing in two people in one day, and one of them a woman?"
"Why, you poor fathead," said the doctor soothingly. "Mac over there was blocking one of Jim's plays, and to get him out of the way, Jim took him up here. Anyway, Mac's one of us.
What's biting you? She was hurt. Besides, maybe Jim wanted that woman's touch around his house."
"Aye," said Porky, "but there's a lot more to be said about that. As far as I go, I'm sick of this feller who stays away from the rest of us, never even gets drunk with us, and now he gets a woman."
"Look out," warned a voice.
"I think I..."
Several heads turned to the open door which framed Black Jim. His eyes ran slowly from face to face until they settled on Montgomery. The men stirred uneasily.
"I told you to keep these out," he said calmly.
By this contemptuous gesture, he might have been referring to dogs of the street.
"They said you'd changed your mind," explained Montgomery.
"I ain't never done that yet," said the bandit. "Hope you've enjoyed yourselves, boys."
"Look here," said Porky Martin, blustering. "What we want to know is about the calico here. We..."
"I told you about her before," said Black Jim softly, "and you sat around and hollered and said she was to stay here. It's too late to get rid of her now. She's seen us all. She could identify every one of us."
"We ain't asking you to send her off," said Porky, "but as long as she's going to stay here, we don't see no natural reason why she has to hang around here in one cabin. We're boosting for a lot of changes of scenery."
"We?" asked Black Jim, and he frowned.
"You heard me before, damn you."
He was half crouched with the fighting fury in his face. The rest of the men moved quickly back, leaving an open space between the two. Porky's hand tugged and writhed about the handle of his revolver as though he found difficulty in drawing it, but Black Jim made no movement toward his weapon. His soft, dark eyes dwelt without change on the face of his opponent. Jerry watched, utterly fascinated. She saw Montgomery staring in the background. The rest of the men stood closer to Porky, as if they sympathized with him, and their eyes were fixed with a sort of mute horror on Black Jim. An instinct told her that the moment he made a motion toward his revolver, every gun in that room would be out and leveled at him. Yet when that strange sympathy troubled her throat, it was not for the bandit who faced the roomful of enemies, but for the crouched,
tense figure of Porky Martin. His big beard quivered. She saw his jaws stir. A strange gurgling sound came in his throat, and yet he could not draw his revolver.
"My God!" breathed the doctor.
It was as if some spell broke with his voice. A dozen breaths were audible in quick succession. Porky Martin drew a long pace back and half-straightened. His left hand left the butt of his revolver, and then both hands moved in slow jerks up toward his head. The gurgling rose louder in his throat. It formed into gasping words.
"Jim, don't shoot, for God's sake."
The whole of that great body shook. A moment before, he had been the most awe-inspiring of them all and the center of Jerry's fears.
"Hypnotism," she murmured to herself, but she did not believe her own diagnosis.
"Take your hands down, Porky," said Black Jim. "I ain't asked you to put 'em up there." In spite of this permission, the big man's arms remained as if fixed in the air.
"Get out," ordered Black Jim, and gestured toward the door.
Porky started sidewise, edging past Black Jim as if he feared to take his eyes off him. At the door, he whirled and bolted suddenly into the dark. The order of the bandit had apparently been directed at Porky alone, but all the rest obeyed, each man moving silently, keeping his face with a religious earnestness toward Jim and his hand on his revolver until he came to the door through which each vanished with startling swiftness. They were all gone. Montgomery alone remained. Jim faced him.
"Get out," said the bandit, "and tell the rest of them that there's a deadline drawn on the edge of the trees. They can cross it when they get tired of living."
Jerry made vain motions to him with lips and hands to stay, and wondered why she dared not sneak out, but his eyes were not for her. Like the rest, he moved sidewise and darted out into the night. Black Jim turned to Jerry, and she set her teeth to make her glance cross his boldly. There was a subtle change of his expression. He jerked a hand toward the door.
"That last man," he said, "did you really want him to stay?"
"Yes," she said faintly. "I'm afraid."
Chapter 6. Greek Meets Greek. To her astonishment, he nodded slowly. "Yes," he said, "they all ain't much more than cattle." With that, he disappeared into the next room. He came back at once, bearing a bolstered revolver, which he dropped beside her carelessly. "They're a rotten gang, all right," he went on. "And that last man, why did you want him to stay?" Under the direct question of his eyes, her own dropped till they fell upon the revolver butt, significantly protruding from the holster. "You don't need to tell me," he said gently. "I guess you thought you'd be safer with two. But that pale-faced one ain't a man. He's a skunk. I told him to keep him out." She did not answer. Her head remained bowed with wonder. Montgomery had been no protection to her. Even now there were 12 grim men who were 12 dangers to her. Yet in the presence of this man-queller, she felt unutterably safe. She glanced at her injured hand and smiled at her sense of security. Black Jim retreated. He came back with a great armful of logs. Hunger and weariness fought like drugs against the stimulus of fear. She found herself drowsing as she stared into the growing blaze of flames. Her ear caught the chink, the rattle, and the hiss of cookery. Then she watched, as through a haze, the tall figure of Black Jim outlined against the fire. Through her exhaustion, her suffering, and her fear, that shadowy figure became the symbol of the protector. He came before her again carrying a tin plate that bore a steaming venison steak, flanked with big chunks of bread and a cup of black coffee. She tasted the coffee first, and it cleared her mind, pumped strong blood through her body again. Another woman would have roused to a paralyzing terror when her faculties returned. But now the strange schooling of Annie Kerrigan stood her in good stead. She was used to men, but she was not used to the fear of them. After all,
What difference was there between this man and those she had known before? She'd felt helpless indeed when the 12 filled the room. She'd seen, and she would never forget, a certain flickering light of hunger in their eyes. They were dangerous, but that element of danger she did not see in Black Jim. Some men are dangerous to men alone. Others threaten all nature, born destroyers. She knew that Black Jim was of the first category. Nothing told her except a small inner voice that chanted courage to her heart. Consequently, when the hot coffee gave her strength, she sat erect, propping herself with her sound hand. "I say," she called. He started where he sat before his food at the table, lifted his head, and stared at her. "What about these hobbles, dearie?" she went on. His eyes widened, but he answered nothing. "Cut the silent treatment, cutie," said Jerry, her courage rising. "And this rope. You've got your stage guarded. There's no fear that I'll jump through the curtain to get to the audience. I can't run away. I'm not very slow. But bullets are a little faster. So drop the hobbles, Alexander. They're a way out of date." He sat with his knife poised and ear canted a trifle to one side as if he strained every effort to follow the meaning of her slang. At last, he comprehended, nodded, and set her free with a few strokes of a knife. "It's all right to let you go free," he said, "but you got to remember that this shack may be watched from now on. You could get away any time. I won't stop you. But outside you'll find, maybe no bullets, but some of the boys who were in here a while ago. Savvy?" She understood, but she shrugged the terror away, as she would have shrugged away self-consciousness on the stage. "All right, Jimmy," she said cheerfully. "I savvy. Lend me a hand, will you?" She reached up with a smile for him to assist her to her feet. His astonishment at this familiar treatment made his eyes big again, and Jerry laughed. "It's all right, cutie," she said. "You got a funny name, but you can't get by as a nightmare as far as I'm concerned. Not without a makeup. Can the glassy eye, and give me your hand." He extended his hand hesitatingly, and she drew herself erect with some difficulty, for she had remained a long time in a cramped position. "It's all right to feed some Swede farmhand in the corner, Oscar, but not La Belle Geraldine. Nix, it isn't done. There's no red light on that table, is there?" "Red light?" he repeated. "Sure. I mean, there's no danger sign." "Say, dearie, do I have to translate everything I say into Mother Goose rhymes? I mean, may I eat at the table, or do I have to stay on the floor?" He regarded her a moment with his usual somber concern. Then he turned and carried his stool to the table and brought her food to it. "This is solid comfort," declared Jerry, as she settled herself at the board, and she attacked the venison with great vigor. There were certain difficulties, however, against which she had to struggle. Her right hand was useless to manage the knife, but she managed to steady the fork between the third and fourth fingers. With her left hand, she tried to cut the meat, but progress in this way was highly unsatisfactory. In the midst of her labors, a brawny hand carried away her plate. She looked up with a laugh and surrendered her knife and fork. "After all," she said, "you flashed the gun that put my hand in the bad, so it's up to you to do the prompting when I break down." He raised his eyes a moment to consider this statement, but he failed to find the clue to its meaning and went on silently cutting up the meat and finally passed it back to her. Dumbfounded by this reticence, Jerry kept a suspicious eye upon him. Among the people with whom she was familiar, silence meant anger, plots, hatred. Evidently, he turned the matter over seriously in his mind, for his gaze was fixed far away. "Lady," he said at last, meeting her inquiry with his dull, unreadable eyes, "was you all born with that vocabulary, or did you just find it?" Jerry rested her chin upon a clenched white fist while she smiled at him. "You're wrong twice, Solomon," she answered. "An angel slipped it to me in a dream."
"Which a dream like that is some kind of nightmare," nodded Black Jim. "Would you all mind waking up when you talk to me?" He chuckled softly.
"Say, Oscar," said Jerry, "I'd lay a bet that's the first time you've laughed this year."
He was sober at once.
"Why?" "The wrinkles around your eyes ain't worn that deep."
He shrugged his shoulders and confined his attention to his plate for a time, as if the matter no longer interested him. But when she had half forgotten it, he resumed, breaking into the midst of her chatter. "Speaking of wrinkles, you don't look more than a yearling yourself. Which I would ask, how old are you, ma'am?" The instinct of the eternal feminine made her parry the question for a moment.
"I'm old enough," she answered. "But take it from me, I don't have to wear a wig."
"Hmm," he growled, considering this evasive return. "What I want to know is where you all got to know so much."
"Know so much?" repeated Jerry. "On the level, Oscar? Or speaking with a smile? I mean, do you ask that straight?"
"Straight as I shoot," he said.
She leaned back, curiosity greater than her mirth. "Honest," said La Belle Geraldine, "you got me beat. You got me feeling like a toe dancer in the mud. You're the original mystery, all right. To hear people talk of you, you'd think Black Jim put the dam in death. But if I just met you at a dance, I'd think you were so green you didn't know the first violin from the drummer."
"Speaking in general," replied the bandit carefully, "I get your drift. But even if I begin allowing for the wind..."
"Meaning the way I talk, I suppose?" broke in Jerry.
"Even allowing for that," went on Black Jim, "I don't think I could shoot straight enough to ring the bell. You've got me sidestepped."
"Go on," said Jerry. "I'll keep them amused till you bring on the heavy stuff. What do you mean?"
"Well," drawled Black Jim, "you look a heap more like a picture of a lady I once saw in a soap ad than anything else. You're all pink and white and soft, with eyes like a two-day-old calf."
"Go right on, Shakespeare," murmured La Belle Geraldine. "You can't make me mad."
"When I brought you up here," said Black Jim, "I figured that when you come to, you'd begin yelling and hollering and raising Cain. I was sort of stealing myself to it when you opened your eyes a while ago. Lady," here he leaned across the table earnestly, "I was expecting a plum hell of a time." He grinned broadly. "I got it all right, but not the kind I thought."
"I sure panned you some," nodded Jerry. "I thought..."
She stopped to tell Black Jim that she thought she was talking to Frederick Montgomery when she recovered from her faint would be to expose that worthy. Once it were known that he was only a temporary bandit, his days in the valley would be short indeed. In his pose as a man-killer, an ex-convict, a felon in the shadow of the law, he was as safe as a child in the bosom of his family. Otherwise, a dozen practiced fighters would be hot on his trail.
"I was just sore," concluded La Belle, "to think I had balled up everything by flashing a small-time act on a big-time stage."
The pun amused her so that she broke into hearty laughter. The sound reacted on both her and the bandit, though he fell silent again and scarcely spoke for the next hour or more. She thought that she could detect a greater kindliness about his eyes. He went about cleaning up the tin dishes with singular deftness. When he concluded, he turned rapidly upon her. "Time to turn in. You sleep there. I bunk in the next room. So long." He turned at the entrance of the other apartment. "How's your hand?"
"Doing fine," smiled Jerry. "So long, Jim."
Chapter 7. Jerry Takes Lessons. She was still smiling when she slipped down among the blankets. For some time, she lay there wondering. By all the laws of nature, she should not have closed an eye for anxiety. She pictured all the dangers of her position one by one, and then smiled again. She could not be afraid of this man. The very terror he inspired in others was a warm sense of protection around her. The weary muscles of her body relaxed by slow degrees.
The wind hummed like a muted violin through the trees outside. She slept. When she woke, a fire burned on the hearth brightly again, and the room filled with the savor of fried bacon and steaming coffee. Black Jim sat at the table draining his tin cup. Jerry sat up with a yawn. "Hello, Jim," she called. "Say, this mountain air is all the dope for hard sleeping, what?" He lowered his cup and smiled back at her. "I'm glad y'all slept well," he drawled and rose from the table. "I'm going off on a bit of a trip today," he said. "But before I go, I want to tell you."
"My name's Geraldine," she answered, "but most people shorten it up to Jerry."
"Which I'd tell a man just about hits you off," he answered. "You ain't seen much of this valley. I suppose you want to explore around a lot, and you can go as far as you like, but just pack that shooting iron with you by the way of a friend. Come here to the door, and I'll show you how far you can go."
She followed him obediently, and standing at the entrance to the shack, looked out over the silver-misted valley. Four guardian peaks surrounded a gorge about a mile and a half long and half a mile wide, narrowing toward the farther end, where the entrance gap could not have been more than 100 yards in width. The shack of Black Jim, huddled against the precipitous wall of rock at the opposite extremity of the valley, and stood upon ground higher than the rest of the floor. Great trees rose on all sides, and what she saw was made out through the spaces between these monsters.
"Where are the others?" she asked. He waved his hand in a generous circle. "All around. Maybe you could wander about for a month and never find where they stay. But if you meet them, they'll be gladder to see you than you'll be to see them."
"And if I stay right here," she asked him, "would I be in danger from them here?"
"They came last night," he said grimly, "but I got an idea they won't be in no hurry to come again. At the edge of those trees is a dead line. They'll know if they come beyond that they're taking their own chances. If you see him come, make your gun talk for you." He stepped through the door and she followed him a pace into the open air. The big roan horse, lean of neck and powerful of shoulder, stood near, his bridle reins hanging over his head. Black Jim swung into the saddle. "Just hobble this one idea so it don't never get outside your brain," said Black Jim. "The men in this valley are only up here because they wanted to get above the law, and they are above it. The only law they know, the only law I know, is to play square with each other. Partner, I busted that law by bringing you in here. According to all the rules, there ain't no place for anyone here excepting the men that's beyond the law. I don't know what they'll do. Maybe it's a war, maybe it ain't. Rope that idea and stick a brand on it. So long, Jerry, and don't get near that gap down to the far end of the valley." He spurred the roan through the trees and disappeared, leaving Jerry to listen to the rapidly diminishing sound of the horse's feet. Then the silence dropped like a cloak around her, save for the light humming of the wind through the upper branches. She went back and buckled the revolver with its holster around her waist. She felt strangely as if that act placed her at once among the ranks of those who, as Black Jim said, were above the law. A great impulse to collapse in the middle of the floor and weep rose in her. All that life of gaiety, of action, of many butterfly hopes, was lost to her. Years might pass before she could break away from this valley of the damned. Perhaps she might actually grow old here, away from the men, away from the lure of the footlights. Hopelessness tightened about her heart, and Jerry began to sing while the tears ran down her face. After all, she was trained to fight against misery, and she fought now until the tears stopped and her voice was sure. The very sound of the song was a cure to all ills. She set about examining the cabin with the practical mind of anyone who had had to make a home of a dressing room in a theater, and who can give a domestic touch even to a compartment in a Pullman. The main room could be made more attractive. When her hand healed,
She could cut some young evergreens and place them here and there. That floor could be cleaned. Those clothes, if they had to hang on the wall, might at least be shaken free from dust and covered with sacking. She turned her attention to the adjoining room. Here was the bunk of Black Jim, covered with a few tumbled blankets. Another pair of lanterns sat in a corner. More clothes lay here and there about the floor. Beyond this roof lay the horse shed. She turned back to examine Jim's belongings. What caught her eye was a little pile of books upon a rudely made shelf. She took them down one by one. Here was the explanation of the bandit's mixed English, sometimes almost scholarly and correct, but again full of Western vernacular. It was a cross between the slang of cowboy and mountaineer and the vocabulary of the educated. There were 6 volumes all told. The first she opened was Scott's Red Gauntlet, which fell open at Wandering Willie's Tale. Next came a volume of Shakespeare's greatest tragedies, Othello, Macbeth, King Lear, and Hamlet, Gil Bias, a volume of Poe's verse, and another of Byron's, and faintly quaint old Malory's Mort d'Arthur.
"Can you beat it?" whispered Jerry to the blank wall. "And me, I haven't read a single one of them."
How he'd got them, she could not imagine. Perhaps he took them with other loot from a stage. At any rate, they were here, and their presence made her strangely ill at ease. There's a peculiar reverence for books in the minds of the most illiterate. It is a superstition which runs back to the days when the written word had to be copied by hand, and a man was esteemed rich if he possessed 3 or 4 manuscripts. That legendary reverence grew almost to worship in the early Renaissance. And when the invention of John Fust finally brought literature within the grasp of the poorest man, the early respect still clung to ink and paper, still clings to it today. Of books, Jerry knew little enough, and consequently had the greater respect. In school she had gone as far as the Merchant of Venice, but blank verse was an impassable fence which stood between her and the dramatic action. When she started out on her own gay path through the world, she found small time for reading and less desire. Books were all very well, and the knowledge which might be found in them was doubtless desirable, but for Jerry was as unattainable as the shining limousines which purr down Fifth Avenue. Her first impulse when she saw this little array of books was a blind anger, whose cause she could not scarcely discover. It seemed as if the reading of those books had suddenly placed the bandit as far away from her as he was away from the law. But when the anger died away, a tingling excitement followed. Perhaps through these books she could gain the clue to the inner nature of Black Jim. If these were his only books, he might be molded by the thoughts he found in them. Therefore, through them, she might gain a power over him which, in the end, would avail to bring her safely from the valley. With this purpose before her, Jerry formulated a plan of campaign. She must in the first place win the liking of the bandit. When this was done, all things would be possible. But she also knew that there was much work before her until this end could be accomplished. His gentleness had not deceived her. It was the velvet touch of the painter's foot with the steel-sharp claws concealed. Those claws would be out and at her throat the moment she attempted an escape or even a rash movement. In the meantime, she must work carefully, patiently, to win his respect, and then, perhaps, his affection. It was dangerous to attempt this. Yet it was necessary, and once this was done, much might be accomplished. Possibly she could persuade him to attempt flight with her. If so, there was a ghost of a chance that he might be able to fight off the rest of the bandits and take her away from the valley. The eyes of Jerry brightened again with even this faint hope to urge her on. All that day she did what she could, with her one hand, to clean and arrange the room. By nightfall, she was utterly weary but expectant. The expectancy was vain. Black Jim arrived long after dark,
and she heard him moving about in the shed as he put up his roan. It was her signal to commence the cooking of supper. She waited with bated breath for his entrance and his shout of surprise when he saw the changes she had worked in a single day. But when he did come, it was in silence. He gave no more heed either to her or her work than an Indian might give to his squaw. Jerry fumed in quiet as long as she could. Then her plans and resolutions gave way before anger. She dropped a big pan, clattering to the floor. Black Jim, who sat near a lantern at the table, reading and calmly waiting for his meal, did not raise his head from his book.
"Say, Lord Algernon," she cried, "wake up and slide your eye over this room. Am I your hired cook, maybe? Am I the scrubwoman at 8 per?
He let a vague and unseeing eye rove toward her, and was immediately lost in his book again. She repressed a slight desire to pick up the pan from the floor and hurl it at him.
"All right, dearie," she said. "Go on dreaming this is a play. But the finale is going to take you off your feet. The silent treatment is okay for some cutie, but if you keep it up with me, this show will turn out wilder than a night of Uncle Tom's Cabin down in New Orleans."
She resumed her cooking in silence. Black Jim had not favored her with even a glance during this oration. That evening was a symbol of the days to come. He ate in silence, without thanks or regard to her. Apparently, now that her wound was no longer troubling her greatly, his attitude was changed. She felt it was not that he was indifferent. She had simply vanished from his mind. He had cared for her hurt. He had warned her of the dangers she might find in the valley. He had armed her against them. Thereafter, she ceased to exist in his mind, for his code was fulfilled. She fumed and fretted under this treatment at first, and still attempted to follow out her original campaign of winning Black Jim to her side. In all respects, she failed miserably. She attempted to read his books. The verse wearied her. The vulgarity of Gil Blas stopped her in 20 pages. She could not wade through the opening exchange of letters in Red Gauntlet. Her mind turned back to Montgomery many times during the first 10 days, but he never appeared, and she quickly forgot him. Black Jim was never at home during the day. He either rode out on the roan, or else he went off on foot and returned at night with game, so that they never lacked meat. Cooking, short walks through the trees, endless silences, these things occupied the mind of Annie Kerrigan. Yet she was not unhappy. She was of the nature which loves extremes. To her own astonishment, growing every day, she discovered that the hush of the mountains filled her life even more than the clattering gaiety of the stage. Slight, murmuring sounds, which would scarcely have reached her ear a month before, now came to her with meaning, the thousand faint stirs which never cease in the forest. Heretofore, she'd never had a thought which she did not speak. Now she learned the most profound wisdom of all, when the mind speaks to itself and the voice is still. Whatever of the old, restless activity remained in her found a vent in the ceaseless study of the bandit. She picked up 1,000 clues little by little, but they all led in different directions. At the end of a month, she felt that she was farther away from the truth than she had been at the first. All that she really knew was what he had told her. He lived above the law. She knew him well enough to see that he was not a criminal because of hate for other men, or even because he loved the thrill of his night riding. He simply avoided that other world of men because it was a world where life was constrained by 1,000 rules. To her mind, he was like a powerful and sinisterly beautiful beast of prey, which hunts where it will through the forest, and when it is pressed in its haunts by man, turns and strikes him down. She carried the animal metaphor still farther. She saw it in his singular silence, which was not reticence, but the speechlessness of a man to whom words are of no use. She saw it most of all in the singularly fathomless eyes.
They never mocked her. They were simply veils through which she could not look. The face changes expression only because man lives among fellows, whom he wishes to read his emotions, his anger, his pleasure, his contempt. Therefore, his features grow mobile. Black Jim lived alone. When he was with men and wished to express an emotion, he did not pause to express his will in anything save action. At first, when the endless chatter of La Belle Geraldine disturbed him of an evening, he simply rose and left the cabin to walk through the woods. It was long before she understood why. The clock which ticks out our lives in the cities of men had no place in his house. He rose in the morning early because, like an animal again, he could not sleep after the light came. He felt no measuring of time by which to check and control his actions. He ate at any hour, now and then, once a day, often four times. Jerry fell into his habits through the strong force of a near example. The ticking of the clock no longer entered her consciousness, and in its place flowed the broad and tideless river of life. That concludes the second of three installments of Above the Law by Max Brand. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
The cowboys went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove. High air.